Today on Against the Grain, around the holidays, we hear the entreaty to think about the less fortunate, at least for a moment, including the homeless shivering in the winter months. But what do we miss when we look at the homeless through a moral lens? I'm Sasha Lilly. I'll speak with scholar Craig Wilsey about whether homelessness is actively produced by neoliberal capitalism. That's coming right up. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. The homeless are a ubiquitous feature of city life in the United States. Although often a shock to visitors from other parts of the world, many of us go about our lives without really seeing the people sleeping in doorways or under bridges and overpasses. We may feel lucky that we're not them, but we frequently assume that these are people who have made some wrong decisions in their lives. But what would happen if we stepped back and looked at homelessness in historical and systemic perspective? Could it in fact be that homelessness is something that is actively produced by capitalism? And could much of social services be about managing those populations living without housing, not for their ultimate benefit, but, as my guest today argues, to foster middle-class urban consumption? An assistant professor in cultural studies at George Mason University, Craig Wilsey is the author of The Value of Homelessness, Managing Surplus Life in the United States, published by the University of Minnesota Press. Craig, let me start by asking you why you use the term housing deprivation, not homelessness.
I use the term housing deprivation because I want to highlight the creation of populations living without shelter is a very active process. It is something that is constructed by city governments, by policy, by real estate markets, and by society at large and how we deal with and respond to all of those systems. And so the concept of housing deprivation, the idea that housing is being taken from people, for me is really important to emphasize, a basic premise of the book, which is that all people deserve housing at all times. And part of what I'm trying to do with that term and throughout the book is challenge the way that the concept of homelessness itself has kind of settled over the last couple decades of both policy and public and media discourse. What I mean by that is we've had a focus on, for a long time, the idea of homeless people and homeless individuals as the problem. So there's been a long-standing policy drive to figure out, like, what's wrong with homeless people? What are the bad choices they make, or what's wrong with their sort of sense of self or their internal capacities that led them to this situation. Recently now, we also have joined with the idea of a focus on homeless individuals, an idea of like homeless populations, which looks at a larger scale, but it also, again, is concerned with the sort of outcome, right? Who's living without shelter and what we can do about those people. And I want to shift attention to the systems that produce populations living without shelter in the first place.
Okay, so then stepping back from looking at homelessness as the predilection of particular individuals, as you say, particular choices that were made or circumstances perhaps, and stepping back and looking at the bigger picture, you make a very striking claim in your book, The Value of Homelessness, and that claim is that the system of capitalism, particularly the contemporary form of capitalism, which is often called neoliberalism, actually benefits from homelessness. How is that the case?
Maybe the first thing I'll say in response to that, and what I'm talking about when I use the term the value of homelessness, the first thing that I want to draw attention to is that in earlier eras, populations living without shelter, the size of populations living without shelter, fluctuated more directly with changes in the economy or labor cycles. And living without shelter was more closely tied to your labor status, right? So we got a massive expansion of populations living without shelter during the Great Depression. Today, what I'm arguing is that homelessness in some ways has become divorced from labor. It's no longer an expression of whether you're employed or underemployed, but it's become kind of a separate and permanent feature of the population in the U.S. And there's a whole complex set of reasons that comes to be that have specifically to do with the racialized impact of neoliberal reforms from the 1970s to today. So the value of homeless populations today is not as a sort of pool of cheap labor, which we may have seen in earlier eras or we might expect. But what I'm arguing is that capitalism benefits, and neoliberal capitalism benefits from the existence of homelessness in a couple ways. One, the creation of the mass and permanent homeless population that we have today is a direct result of the neoliberal restructuring of cities, starting, you know, maybe as early as the 1960s, but hitting full force in the 70s and 80s in the US, where cities are being remade into centers of consumption and a shift away from cities as centers of production. So this is a period of outsourcing of industrial production to other parts of the world, and the refashioning of city centers into enclaves for wealthier residents and for tourists. And so cities become sites primarily where people spend money. People spend money on hotels, on restaurants, on attractions, and sort of the city becomes refashioned to meet those needs. And so, you know, so like in New York City, the Bowery, which of course today has some of the most expensive real estate in New York, the Bowery was first used to contain homeless populations in the post-war period, but then becomes a target of real estate speculation. And so the homeless populations are, you know, if not directly cleared away, destabilized as real estate speculators come interested in that property, interested in redeveloping that part of New York. You see that all over the US in the period of the 70s, 80s, 90s. And so the, for example, like the housing stock of the Bowery gets converted into either, you know, luxury apartments, condos, or hotels. And so homelessness is created out of this new neoliberal interest in city centers as sites of consumption. But then in another way, what I'm arguing is that part of those neoliberal industries are industries of knowledge and service. And we might usually think, when we think knowledge and service, of things like coffee shops, right, or like a service industry, or knowledge like the growth of universities and cities. But what I'm arguing is that homeless populations become a thing to be known and studied and managed. And that in that process of being known, studied, and managed, the impact that they have on neoliberal economies is reduced, and an industry develops around this knowing and managing. And this is not an industry that, you know, it's not driving our economy. There isn't billions of dollars to be made in managing and knowing homeless populations. But nonetheless, there is grant money, there's foundation money, there's nonprofit structures, all of which require the existence of a homeless population to do their work. And so what I want to show in the book is that this homeless management industry seeks not to end homelessness, but to reduce the impact of homeless populations on cities and sustain themselves as industries.
And we'll talk a lot more both about the social service component and the social science component of your argument as we go on in the course of the hour. But I wanted to ask you more specifically about the issue of having surplus populations. So you're talking about how in recent decades, people have been pushed out of places which have been traditionally places where poor people have lived. And so they are a surplus, but you're arguing that they're not a surplus in the way that there have been labor surpluses in the past. And we'll talk about some of that history, you know, that people might have migrated and their work might have been seasonal, so they might have been without shelter during part of the year and so on. That's not the case with the homeless now. Karl Marx wrote about surplus labor, that capitalism keeps a pool of people unemployed and that helps keep wages down. But it sounds like what you're arguing is something different, that these people aren't necessarily cycling into the economy at any point.
That's correct. So Karl Marx's notion of surplus labor, or as you said, what he calls the reserve army, is an important concept for me here. And Marx was arguing, of course, that in capitalism, there will always be some level of unemployment because you need a population that can work but is not working to keep competition for low-wage jobs high. And we can, of course, see that throughout the history of capitalism. We can see that in the US today. We can certainly see that in some of the processes that I was talking about earlier, the outsourcing of industrial production from the U.S., one way to think about that is the tapping of new reserve armies of labor around the globe. But yes, I am suggesting that people living without shelter today, in a more or less permanent way, are have been so fully socially, politically, and economically abandoned that the goal of homeless services is not to recuperate them into labor and not to make use of them as a labor pool, but instead, again, is to kind of manage them with an understanding that the population is always going to exist. Here I'm borrowing from the really important work of geographer Ruth Wilson Gilmore in her study of the California prison system, Golden Gulags, and what Ruth Gilmore terms the prison fix is what she documents in that book. And so Gilmore argues that the expansion of prisons in California and in the U.S. From the 1970s on is meant to capture surplus labor that has exceeded the needs of capitalism. So she's showing us that the need of capitalism to have an unemployed population is met and then exceeded in this era of deindustrialization and outsourcing and the development of service economies. And so prison systems serve to take a mass part of that unemployed surplus labor out of circulation, out of competition, because it's too much, it would socially overwhelm our system. So what I'm looking at is very parallel and very informed by Gilmore's work. I understand the homeless services industry in some ways as a net that kind of catches those who have slipped through the prison system. Of course, a lot of people living without shelter or living in the shelter system also spend time in prison systems in the US, but and it's much the same population in terms of racial demographics, economic demographics. And so in some ways, the homeless services system is like the softer side of the prison system. But I think ultimately it's doing the same work, which is to reduce the social and economic impact of populations that have been abandoned by labor systems and, abandoned by social systems as well.
Craig Wilsey, you write that for all of us who live housed, our lives depend on the existence of homelessness. What do you mean by that? I mean, you've just now been talking about how capitalism produces those without shelter, and particularly neoliberal capitalism. But what do you mean when you're talking about all of us in that respect who have shelter? Why do our lives depend on the existence of those without?
Thanks. That's a great question. There's a few things I'm thinking about there. One is the point I made earlier about the clearing away and the destabilizing of populations living without shelter to produce today's, urban neoliberal centers. And so part of who I'm thinking of when I talk about the us there is those of us living in cities or in, regions connected to those cities that have been, literally made out of the ruins of what had been very important systems of low-income housing for poor populations who couldn't access other housing systems. Even if those systems were flawed, there were forms of housing that existed that don't exist today. So that's one thing that I mean. Another thing that I'm trying to emphasize with the book is, and this is related to my earlier point, is to de-exceptionalize homelessness and to put it back into our understandings of housing. So rather than thinking of homeless populations as a sort of like unique and special case that we have to study and decipher to figure out how to fix. Instead, I'm asking us to remember that homelessness is a product of systems of housing in which all of us live, and in which all of us are implicated. And so I want to sort of put homelessness back into conversations about housing, which it weirdly has been pushed out of. And so in that sense, our ability to live in the cities that we live in depends in part on the exclusions of those systems. But also I want to emphasize that there's shared insecurity and vulnerabilities as well. We all live in those systems of housing. And for most of us, our experiences of those systems of housing are very insecure. And we may not live without shelter, but we live often under sort of what may feel like a constant sort of threat of losing shelter, even when that's not the case. And so this isn't to say that like we're all in the same conditions, but it is to say that there is a system that we're all a part of. And I want us to feel that. I want us to feel our links to populations living without shelter who are bearing the brunt of that system that, you know, in different ways protects or harms all of us in the United States.
Scholar Craig Wilsey is my guest. He is the author of The Value of Homelessness, Managing Surplus Life in the United States, and that's published by the University of Minnesota Press. You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio, and I'm Sasha Lilly. You're making the point, Craig Wilsey, that you want to make sure that we are aware that those people who don't have shelter are not some exceptional group. But at the same time, of course, the homeless do tend to have certain commonalities in terms of class and race. And so I wonder if you could tell us who they are. And since part of your argument is about how social services and the state and academics view homelessness, who are they thinking of when they're talking about the homeless? Because it seems like you're suggesting that it's not everyone who happens to be homeless.
Yes, absolutely. So to say that homelessness is not exceptional is not to say that it's like the production of people living without shelter is an arbitrary or accidental process. It's very specific. So what we see really from the 1970s on is homelessness solidifies as an expression of racism in the United States, of racialized subordination. And of course, there's a whole complex set of factors that produce that. But you know, we can think about the impact of deindustrialization on poor and working class populations of color, especially black populations in the US, the rolling back of welfare services and welfare programs in the US, of course, the expansion of policing and prisons, which has in particular destabilized communities of color, especially black communities. And then we can think about all the things related to housing, discrimination in rental properties, the destruction of poor neighborhoods of color for processes of urban renewal and suburbanization, highway construction projects, these kinds of things. We can think about discriminatory practices in lending, in federal programs, in the history of redlining. And so all of those things together produce a kind of insecurity around housing that is experienced in very particular ways by not just poor people in the United States, but particularly by poor populations of color and especially by black populations that have been the target of these policies for so long. And so that's who comes to experience, you know, again, what I'm trying to talk about is housing deprivation or housing insecurity.
So are those populations, particularly the sort of iconic image of the homeless person in America as an African-American man? And I wanted to ask, does that correlate directly with those people who tend to be homeless? Or are African-American men particularly the target of both social science and social services that are supposed to be addressing homelessness?
Yeah. So that's you're asking a really great and important question. And I think it's both. So I think housing insecurity is experienced most intensely in most parts of the United States by African-American populations. So yes, there's a kind of empirical truth to that. But as you say, the image that we might have in mind is not just of African-American person, but of an African-American male. And that helps us think about the second part of your question about who's targeted by these programs. So for example, women's housing insecurity in the United States has been traditionally managed by other systems, by systems related to public assistance and welfare programs, and by the development and expansion of domestic violence programs in the United States and housing programs around domestic violence and families. And so we've developed a homeless shelter system that, of course, lots of people participate in, but that in many ways is designed around capturing a very specific kind of housing insecurity. And I think this is what you're getting to in your question. Part of what I think we see happening is that it's the kind of homelessness that's in the way of consumption in cities that becomes of interest to policy, to social science, and to social services. And this has to do with the idea of the economic impact of those populations. And some of that has a material base, and a lot of that has a base in racism. So the idea of who's seen as a threat to the well-being of a city. And so in that sense, just as the prison system targets African-American and increasingly Latino men in U.S. city centers, so do these systems of social services.
And of course, there is the whole component of men being veterans who disproportionately end up on the street. But is there also another gendered component that often the way that poverty is seen in the U.S., there's a distinction that is often made between the deserving needy and the undeserving needy. And so this is one place perhaps where being female actually is an advantage in the sense that, that women are seen often as being more vulnerable and therefore deserving help, whereas men often are seen as not deserving any help.
I think that's right. And I also think that the way that the concept of deserving poor has been rolled out in the United States has always been tightly aligned with notions of gender normativity and family norms. So the cost for women in the United States when they've been targeted as deserving has often been to be disciplined into traditional family structures or to only be able to access services through systems, for example, of like family shelter versus individual shelter. And so the gendering produces both the kinds of insecurity, but it also shapes what kinds of services are available to people. And so the history of sort of surveilling and policing family structures of Black women in the United States also has shaped what kinds of housing services are available for them, even if and when they're seen as deserving relative to other populations.
And we're going to talk a lot more about contemporary policies around the homeless. I'd like to turn to looking at how the homeless have been looked at and treated throughout U.S. history. But before we go there, you've been talking about who tend to be the targets of policies around the homeless. And I wanted to ask you about another population, that of queer and trans youth. You actually had the experience of working in a transitional house for queer and trans youth before you became an academic. And I wanted to ask you what you learned from that experience about why or why not certain people end up without housing.
Sure. So there has been important attention recently to experiences of housing insecurity and deprivation, particularly among trans and gender nonconforming populations in the U.S. And I think that work is very important. And I think that particularly trans people of color experience vulnerability in all the other systems we've been naming, and access to education, access to employment, and certainly access around housing. But interestingly enough, a lot of the discourse at a lot of agencies and often in mainstream media coverage sort of de-emphasizes the specificity of what's going on there and sort of has constructed a notion of that gay identity broadly construed or in general produces housing insecurity. And I'm not so sure that's true. So the origins of the book date to before I was in graduate school. I worked for a few years at a transitional living program in California that provided housing and services for people who were ages 18 to about 22 who identified in some way as queer or trans. And the narrative that was constructed by the agency that housed our program, a narrative they constructed, when they were trying to raise funds or trying to build partnerships with city officials, was a narrative of a youth who had come out and then been ejected from their family home. And what I saw in my time working there, that was in no way the common trajectory that had led people to that program. But I saw that there were a lot of common factors across the youth that we were housing. Most of them were youth of color. Many of them were first or second generation immigrants to the U.S. Most of them had spent time in the foster care system, which you then age out of at 18. Many of them had had lots of encounters with police and juvenile detention systems. Many of them had been pushed out of schools, and many of them had parents that were in the prison system. And so there was a really complex set of racial, social, and economic factors that were producing vulnerability. And of course, those factors were mitigated by the residents' experiences of homophobia, transphobia, these kinds of things. But that wasn't enough to explain the, and to get at, in many ways, the root causes of their housing insecurity. And so in some ways, that my experience there, what I saw is that the homelessness was being framed in this very narrow way, which made it seem like the way to produce security around housing would be to address, you know, in some sort of broad way, homophobia or transphobia. But, you know, that's not enough. So the foster care system, the prison system, the education systems, all of these things were producing vulnerability for these queer youth and these trans youth, and not for all queer or trans youth. And not all queer and even not all trans youth experience the same kind of vulnerability around housing. And so for me, this was like a really important insight into how the framing and conceptual framing of a problem directly shapes what we'll do about it and puts in place what we think look like common sense solutions based on how we've defined the problem in the first place. And in many ways, that's the central concern of the book.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly, and today I'm speaking with Craig Wilsey. He's Assistant Professor of Cultural Studies at George Mason University, co-editor of Beyond Biopolitics, and author of The Value of Homelessness, Managing Surplus Life in the United States, which we're discussing today. That's published by the University of Minnesota Press. So I'd like to turn our focus a bit and talk about homelessness through a historic lens. These are themes that you've touched on, Craig, as we've been talking, but to make the trajectory a little more clear to people, I wonder if you can talk about how homelessness or people living without shelter, how that changed, starting with the late 19th, early 20th century. What were the circumstances under which people found themselves without shelter? And then how, in the earlier 20th century, did the state address the questions of people living without shelter?
So as I mentioned earlier, the primary way that we could understand the production of populations living without shelter in earlier eras was through understanding labor cycles and, you know, rising or falling rates of unemployment. And so in many ways, housing insecurity was an extension of labor insecurity. And of course, we see the mass expansion of that in the early 20th century in the Great Depression in the United States. And the 1934 or three, early 1930s represents the first moment of federal intervention into housing insecurity. So, you know, this is at the beginnings of the development of, you know, what we would call the welfare state in the United States. And the response of the federal government that time was to develop a kind of housing that was also a kind of labor. So they were sort of like, work camps for people both in need of housing and shelter. And these were directly administered by a federal agency, the Federal Emergency Relief Administration, I believe is the name of it, which was in existence just for a few years. And then that agency was disbanded as the focus of federal intervention became more like large-scale public works projects, what we typically think of when we think about this period in the New Deal. And it's important to emphasize that part of what was happening here and part of what elicited this federal response was that a kind of insecurity that was considered acceptable for African-Americans in the U.S., and for immigrant populations of color in the U.S. was considered unacceptable as it extended to white male citizens of the U.S. And so, you know, this is a moment to where we can see that the existence of a population living without shelter in and of itself doesn't mean that we get a response or we get intervention, but ideas of like, you know, who is and is not, as you were saying earlier, deserving of housing, like what populations deserve support or service, and for whom housing insecurity is normal versus for whom it's a problem that we need to respond to. There's a very specific response to the broadening of housing insecurity to white populations in this time, and it gets a very direct federal response. And after the closing of FARA, that was the end of federal intervention on homelessness until the mid-1980s. And so we had no federal programs on homelessness. We had what we always had in the United States, which was subnational states, cities, you know, counties dealing with homelessness at the local level. And then in 1987, we get the passage of what became called the McKinney-Vento Act. And this act charged HUD, the Department of Housing and Urban Development, with dealing with homelessness. It developed the Interagency Council on Homelessness to sort of liaison between different federal agencies that would deal with populations that experienced homelessness. And it created a variety of, you know, federal funding tracks and programs that would then be parsed out to states and cities and nonprofits. And this era represents a really different sort of role for the federal government. So whereas in the earlier era, you had a direct federal intervention, programs directly administered by the federal government, what we have today, as we're still living under sort of the McKinney-Vento era, is what I think of as much more like a structural adjustment program. So you have a federal funding structure that comes with many requirements, but that provides funding for then states and cities and agencies to administer those services. And so it's a kind of funny, it's a funny role of the state, but it's actually a quite powerful role. So it's indirect, but it has a huge impact on the kinds of services that we see in the US today.
So tying all the threads together, you spoke earlier in the program about changes to American cities. So just tracing things, then the sort of geography of all of this, following the New Deal, following World War II, it particularly, there was a move away from cities to the suburbs. And then later, starting in the 1970s, and particularly 80s and 90s, a kind of return to the cities as a site of consumption and as a site of residence for wealthier people. So I wonder if you could talk about the degree to which homelessness increased, particularly in that period, because you're talking about how the governance of homelessness changed. Is it correct to assume then that as these changes to inner cities happened, that the population of those without shelter grew starting in the 1970s?
Yes, sure. So this is a really important question. So yes, as a result of all these other factors we've been talking about, you know, that we might group under neoliberalism, and the specific impact of neoliberalism on the structure of cities, so the tearing down of neighborhoods that house primarily poor people of color, the construction of highways to facilitate white flight to the suburbs from the middle 20th century, and then the kind of speculation that really takes hold of the city by the 70s and 80s, all of this has a really direct impact on the capacity of people of low incomes to access housing in cities. And so the population we see starts to grow by the mid-80s, and it's recognized as a crisis. You know, there's a discourse at the time in the media and in government about this new crisis of homelessness. And there's a recognition that this looks to be something that's not going to ebb and flow in a way that people maybe would have expected in earlier times. But what I think is really important to note is like, is what the terms of that crisis were and what allows it to register as a crisis. So if in the earlier era, the 1930s, there was a crisis of labor that the government was responding to, what we see in the 1980s, because let's not forget the McKinney-Vento Act is passed during the Reagan administration, what we see is a crisis of consumption, is this population that's being created out of the restructuring of cities is now in the way of what those cities are being restructured for, right? So in the way of new, wealthier, whiter residents, in the way of tourists, in the way of development, of all the sorts of things that comprise, you know, the consumer city today, you know, arenas and theaters and outdoor shopping districts and all of these kinds of things. And so neoliberalism kind of creates its own problem population out of the ruins of the neighborhoods that it's taken over. And so in some ways, when I was, you know, starting the research for the book, and I was surprised to find McKinney-Vento being passed during the Reagan administration, you know, one being passed under an administration that we understand as ushering in neoliberalism, and that we associate with the dismantling of the welfare state. So it seems surprising. It looks like an expansion of welfare services exactly when we understand them to be shrinking. But if we understand McKinney-Vento as an economic program rather than a social program, right, a way to contain the impact of these populations on cities, it makes sense, and it fits within the other things that we see going on in social policy at that time.
Craig Wilsey is my guest. He's the author of The Value of Homelessness, which we're discussing on Against the Grain. My name is Sasha Lilly. One of the things that is striking about homelessness in the United States is that the numbers of people without shelter seem so much larger than other countries that are neoliberal, say in the advanced industrial world, such as in Europe. And I wonder why you think that is the case, that homelessness is so significant in the United States.
So one way I think we can understand that is that European cities have sort of held their cores for wealthier, you know, white and non-immigrant populations, and poor populations have been contained in the suburbs of many European cities. In some ways, what I think we see going on in the United States today is cities in the U.S. being refashioned along the European model. So you'll have a wealthy core and you know, surrounding periphery where poor populations and immigrant populations are housed. I think like a city like Washington, D.C. is where you can see this really clearly. If you look at census data from 2000 to 2010, there are zip codes all over Washington, D.C. that went from a less than 10% white population to 50% white population in just that 10-year span. And so you see Washington, D.C. for the first time in decades no longer being a majority black city. And so many of those populations are being pushed to Maryland, and much of like the new immigrant populations of the region live in Northern Virginia. So you can see the race demographics and the class demographics of Washington starting to look more like something like we would expect in, say, Paris. So I think that's one piece of it. And then, of course, the other piece of it is while the dismantling of social welfare programs in the 1970s and 80s has a huge impact in the U.S., of course, we never had as strong a social welfare state as you had in many of those European countries. So at the height, the kind of like, you know, public housing that we've had available in the United States, the options that we've had for poor populations for housing, you know, paled in comparison to what was available in other cities. And so you also have that. You have populations that were already vulnerably housed, even at the height of social welfareism in the U.S.
So let's talk more about how the homeless are governed now. You make the argument in The Value of Homelessness, and you have been making the argument during this hour, that the social services that a lot of listeners might assume are there to help the homeless, that's their stated goal, that what they actually do is not that. I wonder if you could explain why and how this is the case. You mentioned earlier in the program that there's even a sort of financial logic to some of these nonprofits, but it seems like the argument that you're making is not simply an economic one, but a broader social one. So I wonder if you could explain the dimensions of that.
So I guess the first thing I want to say is that in the current moment in the United States, this is what we have to work with. You know, so people need somewhere to live, and vulnerable populations access that housing right now through shelter systems and nonprofit systems. And so I don't want to say, you know, we need to get rid of all of those today, right? What I want us to see is how the kinds of services and housing that we have available do nothing to intervene and the structural forces that produce housing insecurity in the first place. So they're necessary because they save people's lives. Living without shelter has a disastrous impact on health lifespan. And so moving people into housing, even if it's not the kind of housing we would most want to see, it literally saves people's lives. And so we need that. And I think a lot of people, like myself, got into social services through a real desire to address a real need. And so my concern in the book is more how the available structure, the available systems, even when they're serving the individuals living in those programs, are doing nothing to, again, stop the flow of people who are going to need those services in the first place. And so one way that we can see this is when we look at what really drives federal policy today. So one of the things that I look at in the book is the development of initiatives around what's called chronic homelessness. And chronic homelessness is the idea that there's a subset of the overall population that is like the most homeless. And what we've seen over the last decade is chronic homelessness become a real priority of federal funding. And that federal funding has really dramatically shifted the agendas of a lot of nonprofit agencies who have come to also prioritize chronic homeless populations, in part to access that money. I should say also, though, that of course, federal money never fully funds any agency. So you can't run a homeless program from grants from HUD. But it's often difficult, if not impossible, to access other forms of funding if you don't have HUD funding. So it may be a requirement, for example, for state funds that you also have HUD funding. And so this is what I meant before when I said we could think about federal intervention as a kind of structural adjustment. So while HUD money can't run a program, the requirements that you need to follow to get that HUD money will dramatically shape what happens in that agency. And so chronic homelessness programs are pretty interesting for us to think about because they actually house exactly those populations who have been culturally coded as undeserving for decades. So it's primarily African-American men and other men of color with active substance use and histories of psychiatric disability. And these are exactly the populations that have been most excluded from shelter systems in the U.S. But we've seen them become a priority, but again, not out of a social commitment that all people deserve housing or this population in particular deserves housing, but because social science research has argued that leaving those populations on the street actually costs cities more money than housing them. And the idea is that they cost cities money because they wind up in emergency rooms a lot, and they wind up in and out of jail systems, and they consume most of the resources of the existing shelter system. And so the idea has been to develop a kind of housing that targets these populations and provides, again, a really necessary and life-saving form of housing, but it's been done to contain their economic impact. And I have a lot of anxiety about those economic logics, because those economic logics don't have a loyalty to like a social principle or ethic of housing people. And so those same economic logics can be turned against these programs. And at some point, the argument can be made that, well, actually, now that we've contained costs here, we don't want to spend money on this housing, and it will be cheaper to let people live without housing. And so so part of what I want to really push for in the book is a bigger view beyond sort of interventions at individual levels, but a bigger view that asks for, again, the principle that all people deserve housing be something that we, fight for and expand the programs that we have now to meet that commitment.
I wonder if you could address the ways that recent policies around the homeless have particular demands about their behavior. You touched a bit on this when you were talking about recent policies to address the homelessness of those people who might be seen as least deserving of all. Most listeners may not be aware of the kinds of requirements, the strings that are attached to the help that a lot of people without shelter have to deal with if they are to get shelter.
The history of service provision around homelessness in the United States has been driven by the idea that there's something wrong with individual homeless people that we need to fix. And in fixing the individual homeless people, we solve the problem of their homelessness. And so we have to kind of like cure the pathologies that were understood to produce homelessness. And so this meant that we have like a long tradition in social service provision in the US that people entering shelter systems have to commit to sobriety, or they have to commit to compliance with a psychiatric treatment regime. There are usually restrictions in living these programs on visitors or bans on visitors. Things like curfews are imposed, and you know, work requirements, all these kinds of things. And all of these, again, are oriented around the idea that people need to be made, and this is a term that's been used in policy for a long time, housing ready. So they need to be made ready to live in housing. Now, for a long time, people living in shelter systems argued against this, and advocates argued against it as well. And there was a movement in the United States that sort of grew out of the harm reduction movement, which develops in the United States around, you know, HIV/AIDS activism. And the harm reduction movement around housing argued that what you need to do is you need to provide housing, and from there people can decide, you know, what kinds of services or treatment they want to access. And that tradition in the U.S. is called housing first, right? So it sounds like what it is. First, you give people housing. That's what homelessness is. It's a lack of housing. So what we need to do is provide housing. And then from there, individuals can be supported to make decisions about, you know, what else they want or need to work on. The interesting thing that's happened with the adoption of chronic homelessness initiatives at the federal level is that they have brought housing first frameworks into play. So this idea that people should be housed and there shouldn't be these invasive disciplinary service requirements. So this has become the norm, and this is a requirement around chronic homelessness programs. But the reason, again, has not been social commitment to providing housing with no strings attached. But the idea is that when you put in place all these requirements that people will fail at, it sends people back onto the street where they cost cities money. And so as a cost containment strategy, all of these compulsory requirements are being lifted. And so the outcome might be something we like to see, which is like housing with no strings attached, but it's coming at the cost of a commitment to this economic logic. I think it's also worth saying that as federal money became attached to committing to housing first principles for chronic homelessness programs, a lot of agencies have sort of developed those programs without really developing within the programs an actual commitment to that. So we haven't seen that all of these compulsory requirements have fallen away, even when agencies are supposedly, you know, not enforcing them anymore. So these older ideas of needing to fix the individual have stayed in place, even as you get a kind of federal framework that's saying that's not what we should be doing.
Well, lastly, let me ask you what you think should be done short of, you know, entirely changing the system, which clearly you are arguing for. But you said at the beginning of the program that you wanted to remind people who had shelter about their bond to those who don't. And usually the way that people relate between those who are housed and those who are homeless is around charity. Is there anything that you would want people to do, anything you would advocate for, whether within those confines of charity or in some much larger sense, to help those people who find themselves living on the streets?
I think there's a lot that we can do right now while we work towards a world that guarantees housing for all people at all times. One of the things that is a backdrop to the book is the ways in which social services in the United States have become divorced from social movements. And we can see this in lots of different realms of social life. I think homelessness and housing is a place where we see it really strongly. When I think about this, I think back to the fact that the part of the Black Panther's work was providing school lunches, right? And so there you had a sort of service provision, like people, kids need food, but it was embedded within a larger movement for systemic change. Whereas today, what we have is a kind of professionalized social services that that is based on the idea that you need expert knowledge about all these different kinds of populations and all their different needs. And then what you do is you provide services to meet those specific needs. And so you get sort of this, like, this is what I meant by kind of exceptionalizing homeless populations. So they become this sort of special case that only experts can understand. And then we provide services that those experts tell us are the right kinds of services for that population. So part of what I want to see is like a repoliticization of homelessness in housing movements and in other movements. There are lots of groups doing really interesting work that is like grassroots social movement work around housing and homelessness. So I think those are great organizations to become involved with and to support. In New York City, there's an organization called Picture the Homeless that's been doing work for a long time in the U.S. In New York, around organizing around the needs of people in shelter systems in New York. There's a new formation in Washington, D.C. called People for Fairness Coalition that's doing similar work. There's great groups like on the West Coast, the Western Regional Advocacy Project, and then throughout the U.S., the Right to the City. And these are groups that are looking at housing broadly and looking at homelessness as part of that. So I think there are people doing work at grassroots level that we can support with our time and energy and money. And then I also think part of what I want to see is people bringing the issue of homelessness into other realms, so that kind of de-exceptionalizing of it. So I think that I've been really excited to when I talk with people that are thinking about links between policing and prisons and gentrification, right? So the over-policing of populations of color in the United States has destabilized neighborhoods and made those neighborhoods vulnerable to gentrification. And so if part of what we want to do is make sure that low-income populations of color have access to housing, we need to protect those neighborhoods. And one thing we need to protect them from is from police and from prisons. And so I think thinking about like relationships between issues like policing, prisons, and housing and homelessness is like is another way where we can do daily on the ground work that actually gets at some of these structural forces and these root causes.
Craig Wilsey has been my guest. He is the author of The Value of Homelessness, Managing Surplus Life in the United States. That's published by the University of Minnesota Press. He's assistant professor of cultural studies at George Mason University. And you can find a link to his book, The Value of Homelessness, as well as links to some of the organizations that he mentioned on our website, againstthegrain.org. Craig Wilsey, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
And you've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening. And please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.